Okay, I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 5:08 p.m. on Wednesday, April 11th, 2018. Present today, we have Representative, Representative Kawasaki and Representative Wilson, Vice Chair Guerra, Co-Chair Seaton, and Representative Wren, Representative Guttenberg, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. We also have with us Representative Ortiz. And so with that, we also have Representative Thompson. And if folks could please mute their cell phones. On today's schedule, we will continue with HB 411, which is the oil and gas production tax payments credits bill. Tonight's plan is to hear from Mr. Rich Ruggiero from IN3 Energy, followed by invited testimony from the industry. And at this time, I would like to bring Mr. Ruggiero up to the table. Yeah, that's what I thought. I didn't think he was here. So he should be online. He's calling from Houston. Mr. Ruggiero, if you could put yourself on the record. And we have somebody at the table here who can advance your slides. And so if you could go ahead and put yourself on the record and start with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Richard Ruggiero, and I'm with N3 Energy. And I'm one of the LBNA consultants.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, if it would be okay, what I would like to do tonight, because of being remote and a little difficult at the time to pick things up, is to be able to run completely through my presentation and then take questions at the end, if that's okay with you.
That sounds great. We'll do that. If members of the committee could hold their questions to the end. I'd also like to note that we've been joined by Representative Pruitt and Representative Tilton, and so with that, we've got a full house. And Mr. Ruggiero?
Okay, if we could start on slide number 2, titled Testimony Scope. What we were requested in our conversation with Co-Chair Representative Seaton is to look over the proposed legislation of HB 411 to give it a high-level overview. And in doing so, what we're going to present here today is sort of a conceptual approach to working this, as opposed to looking at any specific line items in the bill itself. But we will come, if you glance through the presentation, to some observations and recommendations at the end as we go forward. So if we can now go to slide number 3. One of the things that we talked about when we gave our Fiscal Design 101 and 102 courses is that we found in the work that we've done in the many countries and states that we've helped is you always got to have a good foundational starting point, and you kind of need to know what your drivers are so that way you know where you're headed. So what I wanted to do is put down in the time that we've been helping to advise Alaska where we kind of see the landscape, so that way we can then put 411 into context with that landscape. The things that we know that are given, that Alaska's revenues are very dependent on oil, savings account balance have been dwindled, and we know that energy development in Alaska, as compared to a lot of other regimes, takes a long time to bring production on. As stewards for the state, we appreciate that you've got some balances to consider as you move forward. And one of those is a current short-term need on how to call it, how to keep the lights on with the state. At the same time, you want to make sure that when you do so, that you don't kind of kill the goose that laid the golden eggs, which is your hydrocarbon resources and getting those developed for the benefit of the state. And as always, and even companies have to do this, they have to look at their short-term needs and the long-term strategic goals and balance those out appropriately when making decisions and coming up with what to do. As we've talked in the past and as I've listened to other discussions, what I really see as your fiscal design drivers are One is to fill taps, not only to bring new fields on, but by filling taps, and I'll show it in a subsequent slide, it's worth billions of dollars to the state to keep that pipeline alive longer, so that way we can actually run the legacy fields to a much lower production level than they would otherwise with that additional new development coming on. You want new players for the competition. That also brings in lots of new ideas with it and new ways of working, which can be very beneficial. And then in the end, you want to try and get your fair share. But I put down two things as questions. One is how and one is timing. If we can now go to slide number 4, some of you have seen this before, but I really believe it was worth repeating. This is an example that we did. Each of the 4 plots that you have shown there is the same project, generating the same revenues. The only thing different in the fiscal systems is the timing on when the government takes its share of the revenues. So all things equal except for the timing. What you see is I can go from, in the bottom left quadrant, a project with a 27% rate of return, which is a very definite project that most companies would invest in, to the bottom right, which is a project with a 6% rate of return, which it would be somewhat career suicide to walk into your executive committee or your board and recommend such a project for funding. And I just want to bring this up because as you go forward and you look at what to do with the design of your fiscal system, it's not just about a plot that says, where do I stand at a 60% take? Which countries am I better than? Which one am I worse than? Because the actual attractiveness of the fiscal system to the companies that you're looking to invest goes beyond just that headline rate. You now go to slide 5. Again, this, what I really see is for the state of Alaska long term, is it really wants to keep taps flowing and to keep oil coming down that line so the production doesn't fall to the level where it would shut in. And what we have to do is make sure that any changes that we would think about making now or in the next year or two don't jeopardize the long term goal of trying to make sure that you've got sufficient production to keep the line flowing. And because projects have long lead times, you really don't want to stall progress by creating a lot of doubt to where people don't make decisions as they wait to see where things really fall out with respect to your fiscal system. Again, I captured a slide from the training that we gave, and what I did is the plot there for TAPS is it shows the new production that could come on and put it. The red line on it is a line of where, let's say, is the rate at which the pipeline would shut down. And as you can see, that green triangle on the bottom right, which is the extra legacy oil, that's the additional production that could likely be produced from the existing North Slope fields. And depending on the price and the tax regime and whatnot, you know, I've got down there a range of just under 10 to almost $50 billion additional dollars that could come into the state coffers over a 20 or 25-year time period. So when you're looking at decisions on what to do with your fiscal system and how to attract new developments and new fields, it's not only what you will be able to generate as jobs and other opportunities or revenue from the state from the new field, but it's also the additional revenue that you'll pull from the legacy fields, which if new development doesn't happen, That's production and that's taxes you would not be able to receive as the pipeline would be cut off. Number 6. Slide 6, please. You also have another potential large development that'll really place Alaska on the petroleum map worldwide more so than it is now, and that is your LNG project. But if Alaska LNG is like every other LNG project I've been associated with, it will require a high degree of fiscal certainty. What I see from the presentations given by the AGTC is they're looking for commitment style or level type documents sometime in 2019. But And in order to do that, in order to get the people to commit, and part of the commitment is finding the people willing to fund what could be $40 billion plus of investment in the state, is there's going to be, as there always is on these type of projects, a number of conditions precedent that are part of the deal. And one or more of those, and in the projects I've been involved with, one or more of those will always be something related to the host country, in this case the host state, fiscal system as it relates not only to the upstream asset and the reservoirs and the like, but also how it will relate to the midstream assets, which would be your pipeline, your LNG plants, harbor facilities, etc. What I have here is the state's track record for the changes that have happened will definitely shape investor opinions. So we're likely going to have investors being people who have not done a lot of business with the state of Alaska in the past, and so they will be looking into what has happened over the last decade or so, and we'll see the number of changes. And I think this, what might be viewed as a degree of instability, could actually force them to place a higher risk level on the project, and that risk level then will require different conditions and guarantees from the project proponents and possibly from the state. So the only question that I had off of LNG was, is as you look at the proposed changes, how do you see that impacting the LNG project, and how do you see that meeting your goal of filling more oil into the TAPS pipeline? Number seven. Slide seven, please. Just, again, I may be going over stuff that everyone knows, but Alaska always has and always will be competing for capital from the oil companies, and they're competing against other states or other countries. As was mentioned last night, Alaska has great rocks, but it also has a very high cost structure, which even with the best engineering in the world is never going to be brought down to the levels that we see in many of the places in which you compete. What I wanted to do is because I've done some of this looking before, and the rest is the question always is, well, what decisions do the oil companies make? How are they making those decisions? What's the investment criteria? One of the things that I've always used throughout my career, and whether as a consultant or even working in a company and trying to understand a company on the other side of the table from me in a negotiation, is one of the best windows into their thinking is to look at their analyst presentations. And not so much the shareholder meeting, but their analysts. Their analyst presentations are where the CEO, the CFO, the chairman all get up and lay out the plans, both for the next year to maybe a 5 to 10 year horizon. And they will be judged by Wall Street, and they will be judged by all those analysts on how well they meet those. Now, when I looked at those a few years ago, Alaska figured very prominently in all three of the companies. I looked at them again last night, and I looked at the recent analyst presentations and or investor presentations from all three companies, and it's very evident that with ConocoPhillips, Alaska features very prominently. But for BP and ExxonMobil, there are brief references, and when you look at growth projects and growth areas, Alaska doesn't appear. And to me, that's very telling. So the real question is how do you encourage these legacy operators to refocus on Alaska, because you're going to need those legacy operators in cooperation with the new players to get the development that you want on the slope to keep things alive and get the LNG project going. Slide number eight. Last, you've heard me say this many times. Relative to other systems I've helped design or work on, Alaska's is one of the most complex fiscal systems. It's not only hard to administer with the number of regulations and the questions, but it's also costly to administer. One only has to look at the number of auditors the DORs had to hire. And I bet if you ask the industry when they come up, they tell you about the number of accountants they've had to bring on the staff just to keep everything straight as they file their taxes. I've also heard some other opinions expressed both last night and in other meetings this session that takes roughly 2 years or more to put together a new comprehensive fiscal system. But if we really want to take a look at what has been built as a series of piecemeal amendments, but put together a comprehensive system that works, that's simple to administer, and gives each party involved their fair share, it's not going to take 2 years. You can actually get it done in a series of months, and have something that can be prepared for to be delivered to the legislature for them then to deliberate on and decide what to do. We're kind of talking here with Christine and myself, and she said, you know, the thing about a consultant is if you tell them when it has to be done, all they need is a deadline. From there, they can take the starting point, and they'll get to the deadline when you give it to them, and you'll have a good product. So really, all you got to do is get the right people in the same room, give them a deadline, expect results, and they'll deliver. There were questions about, well, we're all not sure where we stand. I would suggest that since 2007, when I got involved with the PPT GASIS, I've seen myself and have given many a presentation on where you stand competitively. I don't think the state needs to spend any more money finding out where they stand competitively, because any one of the consultants that the LBNA has under contract can come in and kind of talk off the cuff of where you stand competitively. I don't think that's necessary. I think what is necessary is to take a look at what the state desires, what you as a legislature believe the state should drive for with this fiscal policy, and then sit down and construct something utilizing the resources that are also in the state with people like, for example, the DOR and DNR. And I know, having worked with Ken Alper, he's a walking encyclopedia of everything that's happened over the last decade or so and how the system works and the drivers for such. And kind of the last bullet point down there is by making piece-by-piece fixes is how we've actually got into the situation, much as you did with HB 111 last year, where trying to make one simple fix actually impacted three or four things that you weren't expecting. I call them the unintended consequences. And so that's something you've always got to be careful of when you're making just simple fixes to things. Slide number 9. During our 102 presentation, we talked about one of the shortcomings is when numbers are presented too simplistically. And sometimes they're presented too simplistically for just because of ease of A, doing the modeling, or B, showing the work. But the one thing that we know is that as oil prices go up and down, the cost structure goes up and down. But all too often, and I'm going to say probably 95%+ of the time, the simple models or the per barrel models that you're shown, such as the ones that you were shown last night, I believe the very simple ones, is they alter the oil price, sometimes doubling, tripling from what it is today, but they leave cost constant. That's not reality. Reality is the cost will go up and down. And so by presenting numbers and by showing potential gains or gaps, they're actually not the real gains or gaps, because they're significantly distorted by the fact that prices don't go up and down. To exemplify this, I pulled out a piece that you can see that was from a prior Ken Alper DOR presentation, where you can see starting in 2007, the total cost for the transportation plus the OPEX and CAPEX was just a little over $17 a barrel. That grew to over $40 a barrel in 2015, and now by 2018, we're back down to using numbers that are just over $23 a barrel. Now, what I'd like to do is go to slide number 10 and 11, and I'll show the concept of what happens when you ignore those cost changes. What we've done on slide number 10 is try and replicate the yellowish-orange line is the current status quo that you have in place after 111, and the blue line is the suggested changes coming from HB 411. And you can see the shape of those curves are very much like the ones that you saw last night. Now, the difference that you're seeing is, or I think last night you saw a cut from 40 to 120. that we've actually gone down to 20 and up to 200 to show the effect that we're going to show. But what you can see here is the green bars represent either the gain or the loss between the two curves. So when the green bars are above the zero line, that's when the blue HB411 is higher than the yellowish status quo. And so you can see the difference there. And the two cross over somewhere around $140 a barrel. That's keeping the cost constant. If we now go to slide 11 and see the same thing, you'll see that the crossover point actually occurs somewhere around 125. And then actually, as you get above 125, HB411 falls below the status quo, not above. And that all has to do with the fact that HB411 is tied to the profit per barrel or the PTV per barrel, whereas the barrel credits in the status quo are tied to the price irrespective of what the profit level is or the taxable income level is at that point in time. So I just bring this up that as you look to what you're going to design and what you're going to do, we just have to make sure that we use reality as much as we can when we present alternatives. Slide number 12. So sort of our observations as requested by Co-Chair Seaton. From the Alaska perspective, it closes the gap on trying to get to that two-third government take, one-third producer share of the profit. I do believe, though, by increasing this much, it will work to reduce your competitiveness some, but it does fix your near-term needs, which is to provide some near-term tax revenue. From the legacy players, I know that they're coming up after me and will probably give their own views, but I think the first bullet point, there was a comment last night, it's a basic tax increase and a significant one. But in reality, if you actually pass it, to the extent that they are investing, because you are raising the tax rate that they're paying, the state actually starts paying a greater share of their investments. Because as they write those off, the state's actually picking up the tax percentage share of whatever they're investing. And we create another administrative nightmare for them, and that they've got another way in which they have to keep their books, set them up, and prepare monthly taxes and pay their estimates. From a new player perspective, which is something that I believe that you would want to bring into the state, it raises a hurdle. It makes a higher hurdle. They already are talking about a 16%+ royalty, and now on the first profit dollar, they immediately jump up to a 25% tax. This is another type of change that, as I have, could spook some investors, as the type of companies that you'd be bringing in, very few of those actually have the balance sheet to be able to do these projects on their own, and they're going to have to look for outside capital to come in, such as through private equity, family funds, etc., and they're going to have to be able to convince those investors that they're going to have a managed risk process for recovering their investments and making a profit. Under 13, slide number 13, kind of our overall thoughts and recommendation is make sure we're focusing on what's necessary to bring in new North Slope developments. I think I've testified to this several times on other bills, but the same concept is I would always make the starting point lower, so I'd make the low lower, and I'd make the highs higher. Now, the interesting thing about a profit-based tax is you only get to that windfall point and the very high tax rates when you have short-duration price spikes, i.e. that's when the price moves, but your cost structure hasn't caught up yet. So that creates a very large PTV. But since costs rise with sustained price increases, okay, as prices slowly come up and you're thinking you're getting to a point that's a windfall, it's actually not a windfall because your cost structure has come up, so that suppresses your PTV. So that windfall point is always moving a bit forward. So the high end, if it's there and you know, kind of complains that it gets too high, it's really only going to happen and occur when you have those short duration spikes in the prices. And my last one is with LNG coming soon, that I really think is the time to put together a comprehensive new fiscal system is to design it and have it ready for the legislature next January. And with that, I'm ready to take questions.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Ruggiero. Just so folks know what the plan is for tonight, after we take questions from Mr. Ruggiero, we do have seven companies that would like to. They're here for invited testimony, and then we will take up public testimony, and then after that we'll move over to the HB 339, which is the BSA bill. So with that, are there questions for Mr. Ruggiero? Speechless. Mr. Ruggiero, I'm not seeing any questions, and so with that, we thank you for your presentation. We're going to go over to, we do have a question from Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Mr. Ruggiero, so yesterday I made the analogy, which is somebody said this is a big increase to the original tax rate, just like if you were paying somebody $3 an hour and you suddenly paid them minimum wage, that would be a big increase, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the original pay was fair. So right now we've got the GVR fields that basically pay no production tax for 7 years or almost none. We've got the legacy fields that up to about $60 a barrel just pay the minimum gross tax. And so, of course, any change is going to increase those rates. But do you think, I guess I'll ask you, do you think the rates that we have right now are fair to the people of the state of Alaska and serve all interests well when you consider the public and our desire for long-term revenue and investment?
Representative Garrett, through the chair. You know, really, whether or not the levels that you're at are fair to the people of Alaska is the decision that you guys have to make as a legislature. That's why I really preface my presentation with, you know, my driver and my recommendations as someone who's been a player in this industry is, what does this do to the major projects that you need to be brought on? And that's where the balance has to come between what you think is fair, maybe a bit more in the tax rate, but if you go too far with that and you actually stifle this other production, then you get into what I kind of call the penny wise and dollar foolish game of short-term gain over long-term loss.
Thank you. Just one follow-up.
Yeah,
just one follow-up, Mr. Ruggiero, and thank you for all the time you put back when we back during the ACES debate and then since then. I know a number of consultants have said the two most unstable tax regimes, assuming you're a democracy and not like a dictatorship where things are unstable for that reason and stuff gets nationalized, but the two most unstable tax regimes are ones that are too high because people will always fight to change those, and ones that are too low because people will always fight to change those. Is that at all consistent with your views?
Representative Gass, through the chair, that is consistent with my experience that when things get out of whack, i.e. too far from a balance point, either the companies are greatly disappointed or the governments are greatly disappointed. And the thing is, with the passage of time and as industry changes, cost change, price change, et cetera, that creates these circumstances where one or the other believes it's too high or too low. I think that's why the majority of the world have gone to taxation based off of self-correcting or individual field of project profitability measures, because that gives a bit of contract-like stability, as opposed to being subjected to common law that can be changed with each legislative session.
Thank you.
Next up, we've got Representative Guttenberg and then Gren.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we are at a high view, so Mr. Gerio, thank you for being here. The weather's gorgeous. So my question is, you know, just in my generation, you know, gone from no fields, no oil, to where we are now. And part of our legacy on the North Slope is on the downslide. Some of it is new development happening all the time. There's the same regime. We're going to be supposedly encouraging exploration and development and production. And in all aspects of those, there are different levels, and corporations have different needs. How do you actually balance them? And I'll give you a kind of an example. We have a tax regime in place, or was in place. Company goes forward, does the work it needs to do, files a development plan with DNR. We don't get to see it. We don't know what it is. We just have some very obscure references to it. And the assumption that for them is that that regime will be in place for a while, and then we change it. And we don't know what the impact is for them, and sometimes it's better and sometimes it's worse, but we only have what they're saying, and we don't know what it actually is, and we can't really see what the result of that, of our work, encouraged or just put on hold. So the ability of the state to actually see what's going on as a result of something is difficult. So with that aspect of understanding what's happening for our own perspective, and the nature of there are so many different aspects of development on the North Slope, which I guess what we're talking about, you know, and the geographic distances from Smith's Lake into Prudhoe and all those issues, how do we actually do something that's comprehensive, that puts people at ease, that that we know at the end of the day that works?
To the chair, at times before when I've worked on either for new countries the design of their fiscal system, or countries that have asked for help on redesigning, one of the first things that we start with is what are the type of projects we think are going to come on, and who do we think are going to develop them? And some countries are only going to target the super majors, and so their system is designed around the super majors that they can fund out of treasury. They don't have to go to private equity, et cetera. Whereas other, and that's pretty simple. Other countries have everything from onshore with a small independence like Australia to big projects offshore that take the big boys. The beauty of Alaska is, as you design your system, especially with drivers of the North Slope, the fields that are up there to keep taps flowing, and to make sure there's the infrastructure and operations to support an LNG project, the subset of players that can come up there is pretty limited. So therefore, when you start to design your system, you're not designing for the mom and pops that are in West Texas or North Dakota or Colorado. You're designing for companies of substantial size, so you can start to say, look, they're going to be subject, and they're going to be listed companies on NASDAQ, you know, New York Stock Exchange, London Stock Exchange, et cetera. You're going to know the requirements and the pressures that they're under. And so that gives you a very small starting point. Then the next thing that you do is say, what type of projects do I think can come on, and how many of them come on, and what time frame? And again, you'll find Alaska has a very limited subset of those. And so actually for starting to put something comprehensive together that is new and kind of takes all these small moving bits and just get them into a few big moving bits, is you have a relatively limited number of companies and a relatively limited number of projects can go forward, which can give you then comfort. What I'm leading up to then is the question you ask is, how do you get comfort? Is because that subset is so small, you can go forward as a legislature with pretty good confidence that if your consultants model for you a small range of the type of companies coming in and the projects, you'll have a pretty good idea of what you're dealing with, and then can decide on how you want to handle that.
Just, if I may, just to follow up, just one quick question. So I understand the concept that you're trying to explain to us, but if we wanted to encourage exploration, and theoretically we gave production credits to somebody to come in, and if they find oil, they'll get or gas at this point, they'll get production credits. But at the end of the day, they don't expect to do that. They expect to come in and explore, and if they find something, they're gonna sell their property. And those credits just transfer over to somebody else who might simply be interested in another segment. So trying to put those processes in place that gives that does that encouragement, it gives return to each of those parts of that. I understand looking at the big picture because it's easier, but when we get down to how do we encourage just exploration by itself, what would be an answer?
President Gutenberg, to the chair, I think the answer was the one that you've got with all of the credits that you put in place in 2007, 2008, which are the ones which now have led to all the credits that you have a balance on to pay. But I think if you look back over that time frame, there were a significant number of wells drilled. There was a quantity of seismic that was shot, and there were a number of discoveries or potential discoveries that were made. So I think what you had in place, while not sustainable for the state to continue to pay those, that was the type of process that brought people in. And I think if you can find a way to offer that with transferability, as you said, to other players, is a way to make the system work. And I think one of the things you pointed out, which maybe everyone's not aware of, but as you look at the range of companies that are out there, some are very much known as explorers. They love to find, but they don't want to develop, and they don't mind selling. Others are harvesters. They just like to come in and take what's there, optimize the heck out of it, and take it to its time for abandonment. So you do have different roles and different players out there, and your system can easily adapt to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Grin.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Ruggieri, thank you so much again for the presentation and your straightforwardness. On slide 8, you have a bullet point that says that we already generally know where we stand competitively, but I'd like to tap into your expertise as someone who doesn't work in this building, I guess. Are you, in your networks and who you work with and talk to, are you aware of anyone in the Lower 48 or even worldwide who is contemplating a tax increase or a tax restructure like we are with 411?
Representative Grant, through the chair, no, I'm not.
Okay. And then more just again, just kind of tapping into your perspective. I know you're aware of what's going on, some of the optimism and excitement around our growth and some of the fields that are hopefully coming on the line here in the next 5 or 10 years. What are you hearing about the activity here in Alaska? I mean, what's kind of anecdotal things that you hear about where we stand right now?
Representative Grant, through the chair, I can tell you for some firsthand conversations. Part of what we've been doing as well over the last year and a half, is we've been helping money find properties to invest in and property owners to find money to invest in them. So we've had the opportunity to talk to quite a few of the private equity players in the energy space, several of which play in Alaska or have invested in Alaska. So I've had some firsthand experience in talking to them about it and in getting their views on it. And I think almost every one of them that I talked with said there's going to have to be more certainty before they would ever come in and make a sizable investment in Alaska, given what happened to them with respect to the credits.
Okay, thank you, Rich. Appreciate it.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on slide 8, you have two things, that it's a complex fiscal system, hard to administer and costly to administer. And is a portion of that being the sliding scale per barrel credits? And if you were designing a system, would you design that kind of an element into a fiscal system?
Representative, through the chair, I've been asked that question a few times, especially during HB 111, and my answer is the same. I wouldn't ever have designed a sliding scale reverse progressivity based off of price, and mainly because I know the way the cost structure moves. What you're really trying to do is find the proper level of taxation based on profit, and so the minute you disconnect profit from the tax, you start to create all sorts of issues. So I would not have recommended a reverse progressivity tied to price points.
Thank you. Mr. Chair,
follow up.
And so the tax system that we're talking about in 411 is self-correcting for cost structure, isn't it? Because it's based on a percentage of production tax value by field or by company and their cost structure?
Representative Seaton, the chair, that's correct.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rosario, I'm going to use a couple different slides that you have, and then I'm going to reference actually a presentation that we received yesterday from the Department of Revenue. You know, you highlight on page 12 that the concerns that the legacy players would be that it's a higher tax increase. I think you say highlight something very important: state will pay a larger share of future investments. And then, of course, you highlight new players' perspective. We're raising the hurdle, and we might be spook future investors. If you go back to page 4, where you use your timing impact with on projected economics, and you use examples of what would turn from a very doable project to potentially a no-go, which would be the lower IRR that you have there. You know, yesterday we had a presentation by DOR, and in that presentation they used just a hypothetical example. That hypothetical example was a new field of 750 million barrels with about 120,000 barrels a day of peak production, which, ironically enough, we have something out there that's very similar to that. The example gave several different prices of oil of what the IRR would be in that. I don't want to use all those, and you don't have this necessarily in front of you. I'm just going to use the IRR that they presented utilizing our spring forecast. So if the price were to follow our spring forecast, what would the IRR be for them? And it's 7.4 is what that IRR would be if we were to change to this new system, as opposed to staying with what we have at 7.9. You know, looking at what you have listed here, with an IRR of 6%, with it being a no-go, who out there has the ability to play in a scenario where we would be putting an IRR close to where you've highlighted is this no-go? If we're going to have problems with legacy investors saying this is too high, and now we potentially are going to run off anyone else that's saying, hey, you guys aren't stable. I mean, talk to us about what companies we should expect will come up here and will invest in fields that could potentially be 750 million barrels at 120 barrels per day.
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, a number of things there and what you went over is, first, in running that potential field and going between the 7.4 and the 7.9, you may think that that's a small change in the IRR, but when you're looking at 30-year projects to maybe even 40-year projects, that can actually mean hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars out into the future that make up that 0.5% IRR difference. I've done enough of these to know that, revenues way out in the future are discounted so much coming back to a net present value that it takes a lot in year 30 to impact the numbers right now, and in that IRR. So although that number and that change may look small, in terms of the dollars of the day, it can be quite huge. To your second question, you know, what type of company would come in here and bring this in? You've got a couple of things that you can look at. First, to the investment community, again, with the projects that we've been representing and have been working with obtaining capital, I would tell you that the capital providers we're working with, this is not a level of return that they would invest in. And they need to see on a sort of a non-risk basis that it had an opportunity for more than double this type of level, so that way on a risk basis they're still in the double digits with respect to the IRR as they move forward. Now, where you might find someone that's interested in investing in a 7 or 8 IRR project is somebody that has other things that are impacted by it. So there's added value that comes in from other opportunities. For example, one of the legacy players, keeping taps open an extra 3, 4, 5 years, there may be enough value in that, that the combination of the added value in one spot to the value in this project would then take that IRR into an acceptable range. So there's several different ways that this can be looked at to say whether or not that is a doable number for somebody or it's not a doable number for somebody.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You said something about the credits a while ago to Representative Seaton. So, and I don't want to talk about another bill, but I'm just more on the trust factor. If we were to pass, say, a bill that took care of the credits, however that was, would we still have a trust issue based on we still have a pass that we didn't hold to?
Representative Wilson, through the chair. I think because what happened happened, the people will always take a look, you know, that are coming up there. They're going to ask the questions. They're going to dig a little bit deeper. They're going to talk to the current legislators and whatnot to find out what are the chances of this happening again. And they're going to need some assurances before they're going to feel real comfortable in turning loose the billions of dollars that are necessary to develop your new North Slope fields.
And follow up? And so if they were to dig deeper and they would see how many times that, not necessarily that we just even changed, but times that we even attempted to make changes, you know, how would that reflect on a big project?
Representative Wilson, to the chair. One of the things I bring up is, and I've shown in my training, is that one of the countries that has changed their fiscal system more than most is the United Kingdom. Yet they're deemed one of the most stable places to do work. And the main reason behind that is they change to higher taxes when profits go up, and then they remove those higher taxes and go to lower taxes when profits go down. They've put royalty in, royalty out. They've had a special windfall tax in and a special windfall tax out. So they move and respond as the industry responds. I think what an investor would look at is, are all those changes that the state of Alaska made, were they in the right direction for the time period in which they were made?
And a follow-up? And so you were talking about, to represent proof, about a level that people would invest in, and I couldn't tell whether or not you were talking about the current structure we have or talking about this bill. So maybe if you could answer each separate, I mean, what we currently have on the books, is that one where we might see a big project come in, and then if 411 were to pass, what kind of impact do you think that might have, good or bad?
Representative Wilson, to the chair, my answer was more generically, you know, given a project with an IRR of 7.4 or 7.9%, would someone invest in it? That was irrespective of what fiscal system it was under. And it was just a generalization of, a project with that level of profitability, would that be investment grade or not within a company? Now, to what you're asking specifically, would 411 make or break that project? In this one, I had going from a 7.9 down to a 7.4% return with 411. Does not seem like that much of a drop in the IRR. Like I said, it could in the long run and money today mean some money, but again, whether it's 7.9 or 7.4, it's going to be tough to find anyone to invest in it, you know, whether it's status quo or 4.11.
And one more follow-up? And I really appreciate that. And so let's say it drops it down, because we're already, sounds like we're already on the edge, we drop it down to make it even less impact, you know, that they wouldn't want to come in. If that project comes up, and I mean, we're not the only project in the world, how long could a project be delayed if we get the numbers wrong? I mean, I don't think they would just come back in a year, but I mean, could it be possibly a 10 or 15 year mistake that we could make because, you know, oil will just sit in the ground until maybe something gets a little bit where the numbers come out right?
Yeah, Representative Wilson to the chair. Unfortunately, I'm going to be the consultant here and say it depends. You know, on the one hand, you have the lease agreement. How long does that allow you to keep it without any activity? Some of the lease agreements that were signed 40, 50 years ago are much more favorable for an operator holding on to the acreage and doing nothing. Modern leases in the lower 48, if you're not taking activity and action, then the lease will expire. So companies can be driven by the lease agreement that they have. A second thing that really comes into play is how costly is it to keep it on the slow burner? Again, if I'm talking something that's down the street in the lower 48, the cost to keep it on the slow burner is just a landman every now and then checking up on it to make sure the lease rentals are paid. But if I'm talking about a location where I've got significant costs to have an office, where I've got to pay cost of living differences to the employees that I've got there, and I've got to continue to keep permits alive and whatnot, if that gets too expensive, they may totally just shut it down, in which case, instead of keeping it warm and on idle, they're going to have to go from a cold start.
Okay, and Mr. Chairman, you used the United Kingdom as an example who changed their numbers a lot. Are there costs and weather conditions in which they produce their oil, is it anywhere similar to Alaska?
Representative Wilson, the chair, in the UK, and just for background people, I was stationed there for 6 years. So I was familiar, although that's been a couple decades ago, I was familiar with the operations. They had everything from shallow water in the southern part and some onshore in the southern part of the UK, where the costs of operate were not that large. But as you move further north and got considerably north with the fields up there, weather was a big issue, stormy seas was a big issue, and the cost of operations were quite high.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And do we have any further questions before we go to invited testimony? Seeing none, we will first go to Ms. Kara Moriarty with AOGA, and if you could put yourself on the record and begin with your testimony. At ease. And House Finance is back on record. And Ms. Moriarty, if you could put yourself on the record.
Co-Chair Foster, Co-Chair Seaton, members of the committee, my name is Kara Moriarty, and I'm the President and CEO of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, and thank you for the opportunity to testify tonight. So AOGA is the professional trade association that represents the oil and gas industry, and this testimony has been approved by unanimous consent by all of my diverse members. So tonight I'm going to do three things. I'm going to correct some ongoing misleading rhetoric that I often hear. I'm going to talk about investment and production in Alaska and how it compares to the rest of the country. And I'm going to provide some thoughts on the significant tax increase that is contained in House Bill 411. So first, you know, time and time again, we hear that oil companies wanted all of these changes over the past decade plus. And I can assure you that is not true. This chart summarizes the last seven changes in 12 years and includes what 411 would be, which is the eighth change in 13 years. And you can see that we as an industry opposed all but two of these tax increases. No other industry has experienced as many changes to its fiscal structure than Alaska's oil and gas industry, and we did not ask for and let alone support most of these changes. So let's...
Go ahead, Ms. Moriarty.
Okay. Are we waiting for questions at the end, Representative Foster?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you. We have endured all of these changes, even though our industry still accounts for 77% of the state's unrestricted general fund today. In fact, if you look at the revenue sources book, petroleum revenue has actually doubled from FY17 to FY18. Other industries do not even contribute enough to the state treasury to cover the cost to regulate them. The constant bombardment of proposed tax increases we see being brought forward by the House does instill great uncertainty among already nervous investors. Yes, discussing taxes makes us nervous. Just look what happened to the stock market when the Congress was thinking about changing the federal tax structure. Investors react to talk, not just action. So we also hear a lot about new production not paying any taxes for 7 years. So let's put that in context. The gross revenue reduction is an incentive for new oil, and the lag in production tax payments for new oil for those first 7 years illustrates how long it takes to make money on a new development. And as the administration said last night, this provision in the tax law was a specific policy measure built to encourage new companies to Alaska. So essentially, the seven-year reduction, or the GVR seven-year, is for new companies with new production. So the way some would talk about it, it sounds like all of this new production that would come online would get this seven-year tax break. But in reality, if you look at our current production today, only 6% of our current production is that GVR oil. So in a sense, even though that 6% is not paying production tax for the first 7 years, they're still paying royalty, they're still paying corporate income tax, they're still paying property tax, and they're providing jobs and revenue to the state of Alaska. House Bill 411 is designed to collect more revenue. It's not designed to bring in investment or production, which is a shame because, as you can see, we are clearly lagging behind the rest of the country. So what this chart shows you is capital and U.S. production and capital spend. So the top line is total U.S. production in red. The blue line is the lower 48 capital spend, and the bottom is Alaska. So the bottom line for Alaskans is if you look at the slide all the way to the right, in 2018, energy companies are expected to invest over $120 billion in the U.S. alone. What is Alaska's portion? Less than 2%. So why would that be? We have the rocks. We have over a third of the nation's reserves. We have a well-trained workforce. And as some will tell you, we have some of the lowest production tax rates at these prices. At the beginning of this session, the consultant you heard from tonight shared a presentation that at $60 oil, Alaska producers net $12 a barrel for legacy fields and only $1.50 for new oils. So maybe that's why we do need that seven-year production tax holiday for this new oil. But if you look at West Texas is $31 a barrel. So producers in West Texas net $31 a barrel at $60 oil, while here in Alaska, it's anywhere from $1.50 to $12. So Texas may have a higher overall production tax rate at these prices, but when you combine that with their cost structure and their overall fiscal plan, producers can make a lot more money in Texas. And at the end of the day, that's where business goes. Business goes where they can make money. With investment dismal compared to the rest of the country and companies being able to net three times up to maybe even more compared to their investments elsewhere, it really should be no surprise that even though we've had slight upticks in production, we have fallen to fifth. So in January of 2018 and February, actually, this is January's numbers, but if you look at February 2 of this year, we are now the fifth largest producing state in the nation. I started at AOGA 13 years ago, ironically at the height of the PPT debate, but at that time, we were second in the country. So speaking of production taxes, Representative Guerra is right. In 2016, when oil prices were around $43 a barrel, you can see from this chart produced by an Idaho study, we did have one of the lowest effective production tax rates. So that's the chart on your left. But when you look at it holistically, instead of looking at a vacuum and only one component, if you look at all of our taxes combined, at $43 a barrel in 2016, we had one of the highest effective tax rates. So I think it's important to put all of that in context and look at not just what production tax rates are, because they were designed that way specifically at low prices that we would have lower effective production tax rates. But when you look at it holistically, you can see we have one of the highest effective tax rates. So as was mentioned last night, House Bill 411 makes some major policy changes. It changes the base rate from 35 to 25%. It eliminates the sliding scale per barrel credit. It eliminates the $5 per barrel tax credit on new production, and it creates three compounding levels of progressivity when the taxable value exceeds $40 a barrel. Additionally, the structure of AS 4355011G, as it reads in Section 2 of the bill, looks to us to be a means to establish a framework for more extreme versions in the new progressivity tax in the future. To us, House Bill 411 is merely a rollback of the voter-ratified Senate Bill 21 and going back to the bad old days of progressivity. And I think it's important for the committee to recognize, because of the way the bill is drafted and the complex nature of it and the effective dates, we think it's very easily to conceive that the progressive rates could be amended to have different rates for production tax values in the different years. It could be lower for production before 2021 and after 2022. So just something to look at as we read through the bill. But the punchline is all of these changes combined triples our production tax. And if that's a medium tax increase, I don't really want to see what a large tax increase looks like. So in regards to the sliding scale tax credits, your own legislative consultants and the administration have talked about what these per barrel tax credits are and have warned against lowering or repealing them. And I'm not going to read these quotes to you because you can read them on the slide, but these per barrel production tax credits have been described as a misnomer. They're really not credits in the true sense of credits. They've been described as an integral part of the system, and they've also been described as a very important feature in our tax structure to be an adjustment of the effective tax rate to offset our higher royalty at low prices. Adopting House Bill 411's new tax rate, turning the progressivity section back on, and removing the sliding scale per barrel tax credit to us reverts the current tax structure to a modified ACES type of structure, only a bit worse, because in this bill, you're raising taxes when prices are low, where ACES raised prices or taxes when prices were high. Constant discussions and changes to tax policy do not impart confidence that Alaska is a good place to do business. House Bill 411 will not increase production, it will not increase investment, and it will impact jobs. So in closing, what is most troubling and concerning for our members is this constant barrage of tax increase proposals. Even though at the beginning of the session, the Speaker of the House made a speech in Anchorage, and when he was asked about broad-based taxes and revenue, he said, I don't see that, and he was asked specifically about industry taxes, he said, I don't see that being on the table. But here we are on the 86th day of the session with a bill that would triple our taxes. House Bill 411 is before you, despite what your leader has said, despite the administration not supporting the bill, despite the administration saying now is not the time to change oil taxes, and despite the fact the working group has not had a chance to review this piece of legislation. It surprises me that this bill and the other bills, you know, I testified on 399 on Monday, that they did, those bills were not taken to the working group, because I find it hard to imagine the working group would not have convened a meeting if somebody would have brought them a piece of legislation to review and to provide input on. So we have not seen this type of impact to our industry since ACES, which somebody described as a 10. So we kind of put this at a 9.5. So I appreciate the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Moriarty. We've got a question from Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But just on your scale, on seeing this as a 9.5 compared to ACES, the projections we've been given by every single consultant is the tax rate here is much closer to what we have now than ACES, so you're allowed to use the scale you wish. A few points. First of all, Representative Edgman asked me let me know what he was saying, and it's not what you're portraying that he said. Can you go back to page 12, please?
Sure.
Yeah, Representative Edgman was addressing the governor's slate of, I think, justifiable proposals that we consider fishing taxes and mining taxes and a series of taxes, and I think Representative Edgman wanted to make clear that that kind of stuff was not on the table. We're going to try and be more focused, but he wasn't talking about oil taxes. He, in fact, voted for an oil tax. You can use the quote if you want, but I just want you to know what he was talking about. I've got a question.
Representative Guerra, yes. If I may respond, please.
Sure.
So through the chair, Representative Guerra, we did rewatch that speech last night that he gave to RDC, and he said it in a broad sense, so we had no way of knowing that he was not referring to oil taxes. So when we hear industry taxes, we hear it in the broad sense because we consider ourselves an industry in Alaska, just like fishing, just like mining, just like tourism. So we had no way of knowing he was not, because he didn't distinguish that he was not referring to oil taxes, so I appreciate the clarification.
I'm glad you have the clarification. Now, I don't think he was being deposed at the time. I think he was just trying to give a speech. So you made a few statements. Producers can make a lot more money in Texas. We don't have the benefit of having oil companies tell us what kind of money they make or lose around the world, except for with Conoco. And in the lower 48 in Canada, where they charge a gross tax, a tax that taxes you regardless of whether you make profits, 3 years of annual reports, and the other companies just don't provide us that information. Conoco has to because of SEC rules. In the 3 years that I recall, 2014, 2015, 16, and 17, Conoco lost over $1 billion a year in the lower 48 and in Canada, where they pay gross taxes, whereas they either made money in Alaska or lost much less. So what do you mean by producers can make a lot more money in Texas? Because it seems that at lower prices, they just lose money, as Conoco did.
So Representative Guerra, through the chair, this information is found in the legislature's oil consultant study and speech that he gave the end of January. It's towards the end of the presentation, around pages 57 and 58. He took the average. So this is the average for these areas. Different companies may have different numbers in certain states. So, but if you take, if you look at those two slides, that's what the consultant showed you. So this is the consultant's data. That's not AOGA's data. It's the consultant's data as he's providing what the net producer makes in Texas versus Alaska's North Slope versus new fields in Alaska.
The chair.
Representative Guerra.
Can you please? Oh, sure.
Yeah, follow up.
Through the chair. Can you please go to page 9? I'm just curious about page 9. On that chart on the right, does that include, in Alaska, the royalty is paid to the state in most cases. In the lower 48, a much bigger royalty is paid to private owners. Does the chart on the right include the amount, the larger royalty paid to private owners?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, we can get you a copy of the report. My recollection is royalty was not included in any of those.
Right.
So, right.
Through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
And am I correct that obviously the royalty in Alaska tends to be about 12%, 16%, but in places like Texas and North Dakota, the royalties can range from 20 to 30% on a gross level. And if you added those in, that chart would be vastly different.
Representative Guerra, through the chair, again, we will get you a copy of the report so you can see the difference.
Thank you, through the chair. I think I know the difference. And just
Representative Guerra.
It's my job to be fair to the people of the state of Alaska. It's not necessarily your job, but you mentioned that we talked about new oil, and I know you had addressed the issue of new oil, but in the future, almost all new oil is going to fall in that new oil category, which is a concern of ours. The tax rate on those fields, those GVR fields, up until about $60-ish a barrel, is roughly a 0% tax with some exceptions. I mean, do you think that is fair to my constituents?
So, Representative Guerra, through the chair, first, I take exception that I don't have to be fair in my information to Alaskans because I pride myself in providing factual information every time I speak. Secondly, in your question regarding new oil, I think the administration said last night it's not fair to say that all future new oil is going to qualify for this GVR reduction. I believe they said that was not accurate. So the question is do you want to provide an incentive to companies, new companies to come to Alaska to get new production out of new fields? Do you want to have an incentive to do that when we have a high cost environment and a high place to do business? And that's a policy call for the legislature to make. I'm just saying at today's current production, only 6% of the current production qualifies for that GVR reduction.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Guerra.
I don't think any of us like to have our words twisted. So what I said was not that all new oil pays a 0% tax. So let me just ask you the question again. With some exceptions, new oil will pay a 0% tax at prices below $60 a barrel. That's what I said. I understand that. I understand how that could have been misconstrued. But do you think that is fair to the public, those fields that will pay a 0% tax at prices all the way up to $60 a barrel, at least for those producers that are making profits?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, if the legislature in the state of Alaska wants to incentivize very challenging, expensive fields, and if they want to offer a GVR where we get a 7% reduction in our production tax while we're paying royalty, while we're paying corporate income tax, while we're paying property tax, while we're providing jobs and revenue to the state of Alaska and economic benefit, that is your policy call.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Next question, Representative Grun.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Thanks for being here, Ms. Murray. So your membership, large and small companies who work here in Alaska, when they look at the changes that have happened in the last several years, I guess the environment that we live in, SB 21 combined with 247 combined with 111, what's an adjective to describe the current environment? in a word, I guess, is it?
Well, Representative Grun, through the chair, it's schizophrenic. I think the companies when I send out the latest tax bill to our member companies, it's a, again, when is enough enough? When are we going to get, when are they going to stop changing or even think about changing oil taxes? So I think another adjective would be exhausting and frustrating.
Follow up? Are they, well, I'll move on. You asked a question on slide six. The last question says, how does Alaska compete for investment capital necessary to grow production beyond 2018? Can you answer that for us?
Well, I think you can see from the chart, if you look at the bottom chart, and this was actually put together by a banker in Anchorage as he did the research from the various sources that you see at the bottom. But that bottom purple line demonstrates that to result in increases in production, you need to have investment levels to $3.5 to $4 billion. And at low prices, that is challenging to do. But if we get back to those prices, one would expect if you had the right policies in place, however you put it together, whether you have a GVR or not, whether you have a lower production tax rate or not, you have to figure out how to compete. What incentives are you going to have so that we can get, even if we just got another 1 to 2% of that $120 billion invested across the rest of the U.S., we would be doubling our capital investment in Alaska.
And follow up, and I think it's hard to see on that graph unless you really get your glasses out and look, but it looks like we're the lowest right now that we've been in at least 10 years.
Representative Gren, through the chair, that is accurate. Those are all revenue sources book numbers.
And then at the same time seeing U.S. production continue to grow in that same time pretty dramatically, and I think that's the point that I take from this is really, you know, if we've been stagnant or decreasing in the investment that people, our companies are doing here, what needs to change? And I'll let that be the question, I guess. Thank you.
Thank you. Next question to Representative Wilson and then Pruitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So we keep hearing about profit like that's a bad thing. So I don't think it's a bad thing, and I do appreciate what you do here in Alaska, and I hope we are very considerate, those who have come to testify. But when we're talking about profits for a company before they even invest, when they look at profit, are they looking like at a field and from the very beginning, from whenever they take it over, because I know sometimes it's past the exploration, or when we're seeing these profits by companies, I'm just trying to figure out the difference, you know, because it seems to me a field profit would be very different than an overall profit that you might see for the end of the year.
And Representative Wilson, through the chair, different companies have a different definition to that as well. One can look at the profit by project, by unit, by company. So that is a question that's probably better asked and addressed to the individual companies.
Thank you.
Representative Pruitt.
Now, I just have one question. Before this bill, when did you learn about this bill?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, in full disclosure, we had heard rumors that there was going to be another oil tax bill introduced as part of chatter in the halls, if you will, but we did not see it until it was read across the floor last Friday.
So you weren't contacted beforehand to know whether or not this would impact you?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, no, we were not.
Funny. We were having a discussion during the budget process. I think there was a lot of questions about whether or not members had talked to the affected departments. So I figured that would probably be the intent beyond just departments and the budget and the minority members that were offering those amendments. But interesting. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Do we have further questions for Ms. Moriarty? Representative Gere?
Yeah. Can you go to page 3 of your presentation, Ms. Moriarty? Certainly, everything is in the eye of the beholder. This is the unstable tax policy you've talked about. In the past 10 years, so since 2008, industry benefited from more money to industry, less money for the state in 2010 in the Cook Inlet Recovery Act. Industry liked that, so I guess I don't know if you consider that unstable. industry campaigned for SB 21 in the 2014 election. I don't know if you consider that unstable. And the three tax increases you have in 2016, 17, and 18 didn't actually involve any tax rates at all. They just involved a scale down and end to what most people consider unsustainable tax credits or tax subsidies. There were no tax increases. Obviously, it changed how much money industry got, but those weren't really truly tax increases. So I'm just, I guess I'll say, and you can respond, there have been no tax increases since 2008. The first two things you mentioned are things industry campaigned for, and the next three things didn't change the tax rate. I understand the narrative that folks like, which is there have been so many tax increases, but I just don't see them in the last 10 years.
Representative Garrett through the chair. Senate Bill 21 is actually both, because when Senate Bill 21 was passed, it was a tax decrease because of oil price. But when oil prices crashed, it quickly became an increase. So Senate Bill 21 can work both ways for the industry. No one expected oil prices to go to $35 to $40 a barrel. And at $35 to $40 a barrel, the Department of Revenue has testified that Senate Bill 21 has been a tax increase. But that was the trade-off that industry was willing to take, because when prices were higher, Senate Bill 21 designs it so that we can keep more for investment at high price and that the state is more protected on the low end. In regards to the two changes to taxes in 16 and 17, we do consider those a tax increase. The tax rate might not have changed, but the administration described those bills as complex, multi-part, and I can assure you all of those companies who had their tax credits changed or tax credits vetoed, modifications to the administrative order and the reinterpretation of what could be used to deduct beyond the minimum tax, that is a tax increase. Just like when the federal government took away some of my personal tax deductions in December, that's a tax increase for my family. So no different when tax credits are taken away for a corporation.
Hey, Representative Grin.
I had a quick question. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Ms. Marta, you mentioned the Oil and Gas Working Group and another bill, 399, I believe. What sort of shift, I guess, in attitude or feeling of partnership, I guess, for lack of a better term, would it signal if that group would have met regarding this sort of bill or would have met regarding 399?
Representative Grin, through the chair, it was our understanding that that's what the working group was for, that if people had ideas or ways to change the tax structure moving forward, I thought that was the deal that was struck in House Bill 111, that the working group was to be that entity that legislators could go to provide pieces of legislation, to utilize your legislative consultants to analyze changes. So for us, it seems like what was the point of having the working group if legislators are just going to introduce bills and not use that process. That was our recollection when 111 was passed. And frankly, for the Oil and Gas Competitive Review Board and Senate Bill 21 has yet to fully be utilized.
Do you have any further questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Moriarty. So we have six other invited testifiers. We have Glacier Oil and Gas, Conoco, Exxon, Petrostar, Endeavor, and BP. And so next up we will go to Mr. Bill Bau or Mr. Westwick from Glacier Oil and Gas. See you here. I've also got Mr. Carl Geisler, CEO to Glacier, will be testifying by phone. Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Bilbo and Westwick were for BP. So with that, Mr. Carl Geisler, I believe you're on the line. If you are, if you could put yourself on the record.
Yes, good evening. I'm Carl Geisler. Thank you for having me. I am the CEO and president of Glacier Oil and Gas Corp. And as I think many of you know, we are a small company operating in Alaska. We appreciate the opportunity to testify on House Bill 411, and we'll be brief. Simply put, this bill and even the discussion of it continues Alaska's fiscal instability and unpredictability. also at current oil prices, as we have assessed the bill would almost triple the tax burden to almost $800 million on the still recovering oil and gas industry in Alaska. The passage of the bill would undoubtedly deter investment and therefore employment in the industry and through the industry in Alaska overall. It's a little bit perplexing to us that with HB 111, the legislature created a working group to examine Alaska's oil and gas structure. Excuse me, guys, I'm trying to find a quiet place here. PR's behind. Oil and gas regime in a methodical, well-vetted, deliberate manner. He thought that the goal for that group was to establish a tax regime that balanced the state's need to narrow its budget gap, which we get, and stabilize its revenue, which we also get, with the equally important, more long-term needs of furthering investment, increasing the flow of oil through taps, and to reverse the now highest in the U.S. unemployment rate. HB 411 is really the opposite. As far as we can tell, it's been rushed. It appeared, as we understand, on the 81st day, and it doesn't substantially, it's not really that vetted, as you can tell by the questions that we've heard in testimony so far. While HB 411 would help narrow the state's current budget gap, it would do so at the very real cost of discouraging investment, lowering future oil production, and increasing Alaska's already high unemployment. Right now, Glacier's in the process of completing a roughly $30 million drilling program at a Badami unit on the North Slope. That is a big deal for us. We have further plans to make meaningful short-term and long-term investments in the state. And these investments will drive tax income to the state, and royalty revenue to the state, and create jobs for the state. Not only jobs through us, but through our many vendors indirectly. Again, not only this bill, but really just the introduction of it continues to spook, and I use that word deliberately, our investors. They're wondering what field they're playing on. And not only would the tax tripling erode the economics of any of the projects we have planned, but equally the negative, it would just help us get hurt us from getting funding for those projects. Who wants to put money into an area where they don't know what the rules of the road are? Whether you call it a tax or whether you call it cashable tax credits, it all comes down to cash in and cash out. And if you don't know what the rules of the road are, it's hard to have confidence to make investments. And so when we talk to capital providers to help us grow our business, whether it's our own owners who are private equity, whether it's banks, whether it's other structured lenders, few, if any, are willing to consider investing with us because right now we are in Alaska and that is not a place they want to invest. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Giesler. Are there questions from the committee? And I'm not seeing any questions, so it looks like it's pretty late down there. I'm Houston, I'm guessing. We'll let you go. Thank you very much for testifying. Next up, we have ConocoPhillips, and that is Scott Jepson, Vice President of External Affairs. And he is testifying by phone. However, we do have somebody here who we'll be advancing some slides. And so with that, Mr. Jepson, it looks like we've got the PowerPoint set up here. And if you could go ahead and put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, and my name is Scott Jepson. I'm Vice President of External Affairs and Transportation for ConocoPhillips. We appreciate the opportunity to testify before the committee today. With me is Mr. Paul Roush. I'll let Paul introduce himself.
Yeah, my name is Paul Roush. I'm Vice President of Finance for ConocoPhillips.
This afternoon, we'd like to talk about three things. I want to talk a little bit about activity on the North Slope. I want to talk about competition for investment that Alaska has to compete with. I want to talk a little bit about the bill itself. We can go to the second slide. This is our standard cautionary statement, the safe harbor disclosure. Basically, it says we're going to be making forward-looking statements today, which we believe to be true. However, circumstances may change and actual outcomes may differ. There's a tremendous amount of activity going on in the North Slope right now. This first slide that we have here, slide three, shows the projects that ConocoPhillips is currently pursuing. In the upper right-hand corner of this map is the Colville River Unit where the Alpine Field is located. The small red dot that you see there are individual drill sites in the Colville River unit that produce from the Alpine field. If you move a little bit to the west, we have Greater Moose's Tooth 1. That's a project that's currently under construction. It's going to cost us about $1 billion to develop. We've employed about 700 people over the last two construction seasons to put that project in place. We anticipate first oil later this year. We anticipate about 25,000 to 30,000 barrels a day of peak production when it comes online. If you move a little bit to the southwest of that, we have Greater Moose's Tooth 2. That's similar in scope to Greater Moose's Tooth 1. The field's a little bit bigger, so we're going to have more wells. Cost is going to be a little bit higher, about $1.5 billion. Similar to Greater Moose's Tooth 1, we're going to employ 700 people during the several construction seasons. And if the permitting goes as we currently have planned, as planned, we anticipate first oil in 2021. One thing I will say is the public comment period is open for Greater Moose's Tooth 2. So if any legislators feel so inclined, a positive comment to the BLM supporting Greater Moose's Tooth development would be greatly appreciated. The next project I have listed here is Fjord West. That's in the northwest corner of the Alpine field. That's an area that we've been looking at trying to develop for quite a few years, but because it's on the coastline and it's in a very sensitive area with a lot of wetlands, we haven't really been able to come up with a way to, we thought we could viably permit it or develop it with the infrastructure we'd have to put in place. So what we did about a year and a half ago is we contracted with Doyon Drilling to build what we call an extended reach drilling rig. This rig will allow us to reach out as far as potentially 40,000 feet from a single drill site, so we can now develop the Fjord West play from an existing drill site CD2. We anticipate total production out of that particular development to be about 20,000 barrels a day. And then if you move a little bit further west, you can see on the map the ovoid called the Willow Discovery. That's a discovery we announced in early 2017. It's a pretty substantial discovery. We anticipate it could have as much as 300 million plus barrels of a producible resource. Our current guesstimate right now is we could produce up to about 100,000 barrels a day, and that assumes we build a new standalone facility similar in scope and scale to the Alpine facility. We see enough production out here that we really don't believe that we could route it back through the existing infrastructure. So if we're going to produce this at the volumes that I've talked about on this slide, it's going to require new infrastructure. That infrastructure could cost as much as $5 billion, would require thousands of people to construct it, and probably support several hundred direct jobs for ConocoPhillips to operate it when it comes online. We also have just finished, if you move to the next slide, talking about exploration. We are in the process right now of wrapping up probably our most aggressive exploration program since 2002. We drilled 6 wells. We had 5 well tests. We constructed 140 miles of ice roads. We delineated the Willow Prospect out there on the west side, as you can see, and drilled several exploration wells, one exploration well called West Willow 1, the Putu well, and the Stony Hill well. This is really an example of the perspective that we have right now in the prospectivity of the Western North Slope. And it's a function of really the overall cost structure that we have in Alaska right now, which is a function of the tax framework that we have. And we'll talk a little bit more in a moment about how things can change if our total costs go up. We also did shoot a 250-square-mile seismic program. It's not shown on this map, but that would be under that blue dash line called Rolagone Route. That was all on state lands, and we're optimistic, hopefully, that we can find some more prospects and go drill some more exploration wells in the coming years as a result of that. So what I wanted to do to just kind of wrap up the discussion about activity on the North Slope is go through this next diagram, which shows basically all the projects that are really either underway or in the permitting phase right now. These aren't projects that are on somebody's, you know, long-range potential investment program. These are projects that are actively being pursued today. So let me start with some of the projects that I've just described that ConocoPhillips is pursuing. On the west side, we have the exploration program that we have just finished this last winter. We have Greater Moose's Tooth 1, $1 billion, 20 to 30,000 barrels a day. Greater Moose's Tooth 2, $1.5 billion, 25 to 30,000 barrels a day. if we're successful with Willow and that comes on stream, it's 100,000 barrels a day and somewhere in the range of probably $5 billion spend. If you move over to the eastern side of the North Slope, you have the Hillcorp BP Liberty Project. They've publicly talked about as much as 60,000 barrels a day in excess of $1 billion spend. You move over a little bit more towards the central part of the map. You have Kalis and their Nuna project. I've heard numbers in the range of 30,000 barrels a day. That purple area between the Park Field and the Colville River Unit, that's the Pica project that's being pursued now by Oil Search, Armstrong, and Repsol. They've talked publicly about as much as 120,000 barrels a day and standalone facilities that would be similar in scope to, say, the Alpine or Willow development, so potentially another $5 billion there. Of course, we have some smaller projects like the Brooks Range project that's right next to the Park River Field. If you sum all this up and take a look at the projects that are being pursued in earnest right now, it represents hundreds of thousands of barrels of new oil per day and billions of dollars in capital that's going to be invested on the North Slope. And that's in addition to the multiple billions of dollars that are being invested year in and year out in the core fields of the Alpine, Caparic, and Prudhoe Bay fields. These fields are really kind of the heart and lungs of the North Slope, if you will. If you go back to what Mr. Ruggiero said, if you don't have healthy core fields, a lot of the other investments that are being talked about right now that are being pursued may not pencil out because these core fields really help support that infrastructure that makes a lot of these other opportunities economic. So this is a great picture, and we've talked a lot about this publicly, and you know, the real question is, well, with this great future out there, you know, what could derail these plans? And for that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Roush, who's going to talk a little bit about some competition.
All right, thank you. Again, for the record, this is Paul Roush. Again, Scott just described kind of all the positive activity that's going on in the slope. I'm going to kind of maybe turn a little bit to a more challenging story, and again, that's kind of what could go wrong. And this is already highlighted a little bit in the Yoga slide and also by Mr. Ruggiero. And that's really that we could lose out in the competition for investment dollars with unconventionals in the lower 48. And that's what we've kind of covered on this slide. And I'll run through this pretty quickly because you've heard some of this background already. But what we've depicted on this slide are the major unconventional plays in lower 48. The areas identified in red are the gas plays. Really more interest are those in green, which are the oil plays. And you can see the resources associated with each of these plays, which really are staggering numbers. To put this in perspective for me, I kind of asked around today kind of what sort of comparable figures do we have for Prudhoe Bay, which I think we all recognize in Alaska is a massive field. And the amount of resources associated with that, you know, including what's already been produced, is around 20 billion BOEs, I apologize. So when you look at these numbers, 20 to 40 billion BOEs at Bakken, 50 to 115 billion BOEs at Permian Basin, 35 to 60 billion at Eagle Ford. These are just staggering amount of resources, really just kind of unlimited amounts of resources. And as, you know, the Yoga presentation touched on, capital dollars are clearly moving to these areas, so this is what we need to compete with. I pulled up this afternoon as well just the Baker Hughes rig count, which is another kind of reference to the activity going on in Lower 48. There's approximately 500 rigs active in Texas currently. The number for Alaska was approximately 8. So again, this is the concern that we're going to lose out. We're already losing out for those investment dollars. And really, what do these resources offer that are such, make it so challenging for Alaska to compete? It's really identified on the top of those bullet points on top of the slide. In addition to the tremendous resource, you've got just a lower cost to develop. They're closer to market. They don't have to ship their oil 800 miles down a pipeline. Easier to permit. And permitting sounds fairly simple, but what that really translates to is they can be producing, you know, within months or weeks of the time they drill, whereas in Alaska you may make a discovery and it could be up to 10 years or longer before that oil ever sees market. So again, that adds to the cost of developing a project. Stable fiscal policy, again, we've talked about that at length already today. And what that amounts to really is, if you look at kind of the last bullet point on the left, is really a lower cost of supply, which is another way of saying a lower break-even point, or a break-even price. This was mentioned in the presentation from the DOR yesterday, and it was, again, highlighted already this evening. under the current fiscal regime in Alaska, the break-even price for this kind of notional development on the slope is approximately $72 a barrel, and that's going to increase under this proposed tax bill to $75 a barrel. Again, as a reference point, and again, you'd see for more detail, you can see this in the ConocoPhillips analyst presentation that Mr. Ruggiero mentioned. We have over 8 billion barrels of resources identified in unconventional areas in lower 48 with a cost of supply, which is effectively our break even, that average below $35. So again, that's reality. That is the competition we're facing. We've got projects in lower 48 that have a cost of supply or a break even price of below $35. So again, that's what could go wrong. We need to make sure we remain competitive with these opportunities in lower 48. And I guess one other thing that I'd add to that is when we look at the cost of supply or the cost to develop, I mentioned one factor is the time to develop, but it's really all inclusive. You know, we're not looking at just production tax. We're looking at production tax, royalty, state income tax, federal tax, the development cost, the operating cost. It's really kind of an all-in type number that we need to consider. And again, Alaska needs to compete kind of in that complete basis. All right, with that, please turn to the next slide. Sorry, I guess before we do that, I do want to address the question that Representative Guerra had raised on the difference in the earnings between Alaska and lower 48, because when I talk about kind of this lower cost of supply in Alaska, it certainly kind of brings that to the forefront. And if I reference 2017 earnings, Representative Guerra is absolutely correct in that lower 48 reported negative net income. For 2017, it was $444 million. Alaska reported positive earnings of $652 million. The one factor, and I hate to turn to accounting in this kind of context, but one thing to consider is that is a reported net income number. It's not a net cash flow number. And really, to convert that net income number to a cash flow number, you need to add back what we call depreciation, which is really just a way of amortizing or expensing the capital investments that we made in the past. In the lower 48, primarily because they made significant infrastructure investments over the last several years in these unconventionals, and they're booking their reserves at a much slower pace than what we do in Alaska, they have significantly higher DD&A. For 2017, they had DD&A expense of $2.7 billion. That's a non-cash item. It purely affects your financial earnings. Alaska had a DD&A of $846 million. So if you normalize for those non-cash items, you come up with a cash flow in Alaska before investing at $1.5 billion. Lower 48 comes out at $2.3 billion. So again, that puts certainly the type of numbers you expect to see in lower 48. The other factor that's in there is, I don't know the basis exactly of the slide that AOGA presented, but it shows a $60 oil price. If you look at our reported results that we report externally, you're seeing a combination of both gas and oil activities. In lower 48, the oil component of our production is roughly 45%. So those reported financials are also factored down by a much lower gas price. In contrast, Alaska oil production is maybe 99%. So it's pretty much entirely oil in Alaska. And just as an aside, you've probably seen that we divested our San Juan assets last year. Those were our significant gas properties that we had in lower 48. We've divested those. And again, if you look at the map that I just showed, the areas we are active in the unconventional are the liquids-rich areas. So you're going to see that mix changing significantly over the near term. So I apologize for getting into that detail, but I just kind of want to get that out there. All right, so with that, we'll turn to the next slide, if you please. Slide number 7. And again, the headline here, really, again, you heard this one already, but we have no way of looking at this tax bill other than seeing it as a significant tax increase. And there's two charts that depict that on this slide. And if you look first, kind of at the one on the left, which I'd call the shark's fin for obvious reasons, we got whether good or bad, but we've got the shape of a shark's fin here. And what we've graphed is the increase in production tax under House Bill 411. And we've done that at various prices you can see on the bottom at various Alaska North Slope West Coast, prices ranging between $30 and $120. And the peak increase there comes out at, just mathematically, 223% at $66 a barrel. So, again, we would see that as a significant tax increase. It's an increase of roughly $5 a barrel in the tax. And, again, given what we just talked through on the competition that we're facing in the lower 48, that is going to make those investments even less competitive. The second chart, what we've graphed here is the tax, the production tax as a percent of GVPP, with a red line representing House Bill 411 and the blue line representing the existing tax structure. And again, you can see the delta between the two represents the increase in the tax as a percentage of GVPP as we go through the prices between $30 and $120. So again, this is what we would characterize as a significant increase. In particular, when you look kind of in the $65 to $70 range, you see the greatest increases where we're going from kind of a 4 to 5% gross tax to a 13 to 14% gross tax. And you can see in the red line under the new tax, you're also maintaining the minimum tax, the 4% minimum tax, and also retaining the progressive nature, which you really have already in the existing tax, but you're kind of maintaining all of those components. All right, with that, please turn to the next slide, slide number 8. And you've seen this slide, we presented it, ConocoPhillips presented this initially at the House Resources Committee meeting on January 29th. And I know in the House Finance Committee meeting you had last night as well, an identical chart was presented by Co-Chair Seaton. And he also included a similar version of this chart from 2017. We added this again, and I apologize for showing you slides you've already seen before. We wanted to clarify really what was driving the change in the producer and state share between the increase as the producer that we took our share out of the state, or as I think it was explained last night, that our producer share increased because it was taken right out of the state share. And that is not what happened. So we wanted to do is kind of walk through the slide and what it captures and why it changed from the between the 2 years. And I guess before I do that, just to ground everybody in the chart, you I think you've seen similar versions of this chart from us in the past, but just to kind of walk through it on the y-axis, you can see the net cash flow. In what we're describing here, this is the net cash flow after covering the operating and capital expenditures. So it's kind of what you've got available to share with the three parties here. And then we're showing how that net cash flow is divided between the producer in blue, the federal share in the green, and then the state share, or the Alaska state share in green. And what the bars represent is both the those respective shares in absolute dollar terms and then also in percentages. So, again, just going through that to ground everybody on the chart. And this is based on data taken from the revenue sources book. In this particular case, fiscal year 2018 from the 2017 fall RSB. And what was described last night is there is comparison made to the similar chart from 2016, and it described how the producer share went from 37% to 48%. And the state share decreased from 43 to 39. And again, the implication was that the increase in the state share we kind of took from state. And what really happened over that period was there were really three major changes. And I think the first one everybody's aware of, and that's a change in the federal tax, reducing the federal tax from 35% to 21%. And this change, I mean, just by kind of definition, if you will, it increases the producer share. And that offset came directly from the federal share. So the federal share dropped from 20% down to 13%. That change, again, in no way impacts the state share. There was no money in that case taken from the state. It's purely a change between the federal and the state share. The other two changes were really improvements that benefit really everybody in Alaska, and that's The improvements that we saw in a significant cost reduction between the 2016 and 2017 forecast in the RSV. And the other was an increase in production. Again, both of those are positive things for the producers and for the state. Really just because of the tax system that's in place, which at the price that was discussed here was $65 a barrel, you're in a gross tax position. So the bulk of those benefits for those two changes end up going to the producer. I mean, the state does benefit. The state share, again, in absolute dollar terms, does increase, but simply because of the gross tax, the producer takes a much greater share, if you will, of those improvements that were made both in cost and in production. And kind of just as a reminder, Ed, when we were sitting here a year ago or a year and a half ago, the producers were all looking at kind of very challenging positions. So they really had to reduce their costs really to stay competitive. And that's what we've done. And that's what you see in these calculations. So again, hopefully that clarifies. Again, I apologize for doing this over the phone. It's a little bit more difficult, but you see those changes in the percentages. But if you look again at the absolute dollar terms, really the only party that saw a reduction in dollar terms is the feds, and that's again based on their reduction in the income tax rate. All right, well, I'll turn it back over to Scott.
This is Scott Jepson. I'll wrap up with this last slide. There's been a lot of talk over the last several days about where Alaska ranks on a relative basis for things like royalties and severance taxes. The point I want to make is that total cost is what matters. We take a look at investment. We run our economic. We run not just the royalty rates, the severance tax rates, but the operating costs, the capital costs that go into making the investment. Total cost drives the competitiveness. And as Paul showed just a few minutes ago, Alaska has some pretty stiff competition. The cost of supply for a lot of these unconventionals is lower than what we see in Alaska. Alaska, though, is able to compete because of the things that, you know, speaking for ConocoPhillips, we've done to increase efficiency and take cost out of the system. We're at the higher end of the bandwidth of the cost of supply spectrum that ConocoPhillips is investing in, but we've managed to keep ourselves competitive with the lower 48. If we see tax increases, particularly big tax increases like are being proposed here, it drives our cost up, drives our cost of supply up, it makes us less competitive, we're going to get fewer investment dollars. One of the other things has been positive over the last few years, and this kind of gets into the discussion we had a few minutes ago with Cara Moriarty and Representative Guerra, is there have been changes in the tax framework over the last 4 years, but the core tax structure actually has stayed in place. And that actually has benefited investment in Alaska, particularly going through this downturn. We have a tax framework that's sensitive to price, so that has helped keep ConocoPhillips investing. Even though we've seen some low prices, we have still stayed with our investment plans for things like GMT-1, still pursuing development drilling in some of our core fields. So that's been a positive thing, and what it has done is it has helped keep production up. I think everybody's well aware that since SB 21 passed in 2013, production has leveled off. We've had